Good evening, everyone. If I could ask you just to take your seats, that would be wonderful. It is fantastic to see so many people here tonight, and I think is very much a reflection of the importance and the interest in the topic. Thank you very much. So I'll just do some introductions and perhaps a bit of an overview about the evening and the nature of the book. I'm Steve McGuire. I'm head of school of business management and economics. And this, for those of you who don't know, is the school's main building. This is the Jubilee Lecture Theater. And the school is comprised of three departments, business and management, economics, and the science policy research unit, where Mariana is part of the team. So welcome on behalf of the school, and I think, if I may, on behalf also too of IDS, Institute of Development Studies, and Global Studies, who are sort of all in classic Sussex style, all sort of co-hosting tonight's event. Why, though, for all that, am I nonetheless glad that we've actually housed it here for tonight? I think partly because management schools, and BMEC is seen as Sussex's management school. Management schools have had, in a sense, a terrible financial crisis. I think Richard Whittington from Oxford pointed out that we, particularly strategy scholars, seem to have very little to say about why some multinationals attracted so much criticism. And he wanted to talk about and suggest that perhaps our overemphasis on the for-profit corporation and our overemphasis on simple financial performance metrics contributed to that problem, our inability to say much about broader perspectives. So in a sense, I think it's great that both in BMEC, we have a lot of people who look at things beyond the for-profit corporation. And then tonight is part of this, part of our commitment to saying something just a bit different as a management school about it. Related to that, I think, is we're part of a broader debate. Those of you, if any of you have seen our new website, you will see something we call the public realm up there as one of our distinctive themes. And it really owes a lot to Mariana and the work of other people. We just don't work in a world where there is this thing called the private sector, and it does stuff, and there's this thing called the public sector, and it does some stuff. And very often, we don't think it does it well, when in fact, that's not the case. We want a much more complicated, nuanced, sophisticated version of capitalism and our understanding of it. So I think that's the second point to be made here. The book is saying something extremely important about the nature of major societal challenges and how we have to get beyond this binary division. And then finally, of course, the panel represents, I think, a key contribution of Sussex, which is that big problems, complicated problems, require lots of different disciplinary perspectives. And so you get interdisciplinary work when you have good, strong disciplines, but people are committed to working together and to understanding and appreciating the complexity of the problem. So tonight, to take us through this a very, very important book, I'll just introduce people as they sort of from my left, your right, as we go through, and then turn the floor over to Michael. So Mariana Mazzucato is to my immediate left. She is R.M. Phillips Professor of the Economics of Innovation in SPRU and is one of the co-editors of the book. Mike Jacobs is a visiting professor at UCL, the School of Public Policy and the Department of Political Science, if I'm right. Melissa Leach then joins us. She is Director of Institute of Development Studies. Stephanie Griffith-Jones is, you lead the Financial Markets Program at Columbia University, so is joining us from New York. And finally, Carlotta Perez, very well known to many of us in BMEC. She is Centennial Professor at the London School of Economics and an Honorary Professor of the University of Sussex and, of course, of SPRU. So without further ado, Michael, please, the floor is yours. Thank you again, everyone.
Thank you very much indeed, and thank you to all of you for coming. So in this multiple act that you have here at the front, I'm going to present the key themes of this book, which Mariana and I have edited, Rethinking Capitalism. And then other authors and contributors here are going to talk about specific parts of and arguments that we make in the book. Our starting point for this was what has become now quite a famous moment in the history of economics, at least for those people thinking in this way, which was in November 2008, when the Queen visited the London School of Economics. Now, you may recall that in November 2008, we'd had Lehman Brothers crash, and we were beginning to understand that following the crash of Lehman Brothers, a big crisis was engulfing the financial world. And people had begun to realise the scale of this thing. The Queen's visit to the LSE had long been planned for many years before. She was opening a new building. But it turned out that she was much more interested in the assembled economists from the LSE who had come to see her opening the building. And she asked a very simple and pointed question to them. Given the scale of the crash which was then unfolding, why had nobody seemed to spot it coming? This was an embarrassing enough question to cause some foot shuffling, and indeed the foot shuffling then became slightly official because the British Academy decided that this was a question to which the Queen, she being the Queen, ought to have an answer. And indeed they convened a symposium and process and subsequently sent her a letter trying to explain why very, very few economists had seen this coming. There are, in fact, and there were two crucial reasons which they identified. The one was that the economist whose job it is, and many economists study particular parts of the economy, so in a sense it wasn't their responsibility. You might have thought it might have been, but it wasn't their responsibility to see these things coming. The ones who are meant to study the whole economy, the macroeconomists, particularly the modellers, who try and study the way in which the economy is likely to behave in the future, did not have the financial sector as a substantive part of their models, and therefore were not really tracking what was going on in the financial sector at all. Now, you might say, given the scale of the financial sector, why was that? It was because the financial sector was seen as the cipher through which the real economy worked. The financial sector merely processed the financial flows. Now, of course, we now know the financial sector was doing much more than that and was behaving in ways which had huge impacts on the real economy. The second reason was that the economists who were studying the financial sector, and there are many of those, had adopted what one version or another of what was known as the efficient markets hypothesis, which was that financial markets, above all financial markets, were very good at pricing their assets because they were all about the information that was embedded in those financial flows, and what financial markets were doing was accurately pricing the assets in the economy, and doing so on an extremely efficient basis, much more efficient, these economists said, than most sectors were doing. And the efficient markets hypothesis underpinned the deregulatory policy and the policy towards financial regulation, particularly of the Fed, the Federal Reserve, in the US. And Alan Greenspan, the then chairman of the Federal Reserve, he came to London, and I can remember hearing him speak about the way in which the huge creation of new financial instruments, the things that we later learned, the credit default swaps, the derivatives and so on, were spreading risk throughout the economy, and in spreading risk by the creation of many new financial instruments were reducing it. And that we had found a way of reducing financial risk in the economy through the creation of a much larger financial sector dealing in many new kinds of instruments. And he had to admit later, when he was hauled before Congress to justify the Fed's position in not understanding what had been going on in the financial markets, he had to admit that there was, as he put it, slightly disingenuously, a flaw in the thesis. And that flaw was that these markets were not, in fact, pricing the assets efficiently at all. They were systematically mispricing them, and that their herd behaviour was meaning that this had become a huge problem. And, of course, the spreading of those financial assets throughout the economy, far from reducing risk, had actually spread it right across the economy. And so many, many institutions, many of whom obviously didn't really understand the assets that they were holding were included within. And there was a third thing going on at that time in economics, which was a general feeling amongst macroeconomists that the core problems of boom and bust had largely been solved by the new approach to fiscal and monetary policy. Policy broadly adopted across the Western world, in which you had independent central banks using very public inflation targeting, public minutes of meetings, and that this, through the means of expectations, would dampen the business cycle. Gordon Brown never actually said that he had abolished boom and bust, but he didn't go far from it. And it was a general consensus that we were not going to see those huge amplitudes in business cycles before, which was another thing which was patently wrong. The core thesis behind our book, Rethinking Capitalism, is that the Queen's question at the LSE went to the heart of two huge and interrelated failures. The one most obvious failure was that capitalism very nearly collapsed. If it had not been for the huge, massive interventions of governments in recapitalizing the major banks right across Europe, in the US and in Europe, capitalism in some sense would have collapsed at that point. Huge failure in the economy, but matched by another huge failure, which was the failure of the economics discipline and profession to properly understand what was happening. And our argument is that these failures are related. It is because we've not got a rich enough account within economics of the way in which capitalism now is structured and works, not a theoretical form of capitalism, but the actual form of capitalism in real institutions and companies and markets that exist today, because we haven't got a good enough account of that in orthodox economics, that we have not understood what was going on properly, and the policies that governments have used to try and manage the economy have been inadequate and underperforming. I think it's crucial to understand just how underperforming our economies have been. The financial crash is obviously the most egregious example of this. But many of the problems of capitalism today, ones which we have become, I hope, we are becoming a bit more aware of as we get to grips with the implications of Brexit, although it's not clear that everybody in government has quite understood these yet, are much more long-standing. So they go back well beyond the financial crisis. We characterise in the book three primary crises or key problems in capitalism, and I shall go through these very briefly. One is weak and unstable growth. The unstable thing, I think, we are now well aware of. And most analysts of the financial system do not believe at all that the reforms that have been put in place since the crash are sufficient to stabilise the financial system. Many of Europe's banks, including Deutsche Bank, as you'll have heard in the last couple of weeks, are still deeply unstable. And we've had more and more of these financial crises over recent years. The financial crash was much the largest, but there have been many more of them since the deregulation of the financial sector in the 1980s than there had been before. And this is partly to do, as Mariana's own work and the work of Bill Lazonik, one of our authors, has shown, that we have a much more financialized economic system, both in the sense that the financial sector is much bigger than it used to be, much, much bigger than it used to be, but also that our companies are much more financialized vehicles. And we have the rather extraordinary situation now in which Fortune 500 companies, the biggest 500 companies, are returning to their shareholders in dividends and buybacks, which they are buying back their own shares, more money now on an annual basis than they are earning. And the extent to which companies are buying back their own shares, and I think Mariana may talk about this a bit more, indicates a really severe problem. Two problems. One is of the way in which those companies are managed and whose interests they're managed for, because money that goes back to buy shares is not going into investment. And it suggests that there may be something wrong in corporate governance. But it's also, if by money not going into investment, it's not going into the engine of economic growth. And we have a system now which is generating huge amounts of profit and dividend return to shareholders, often to the senior executives, but is not investing. And if you look at investment in all the major developed economies, it is on a declining trajectory. Stephanie may talk a little bit about this. And we are not investing as much as we were, and the UK is investing about 5% less as a proportion of GDP than anywhere else. And we are now, as a result of these long-standing problems, in a deeply abnormal situation. You should not be taken in by proclamations from government that says the government is in a strong position to withstand the impacts of Brexit. We are in a very weak position, but this is also true of most developed economies. We have more or less zero interest rates, and in some cases negative interest rates, though there is $13 trillion of sovereign debt now at negative interest rates, negative yield, where people are paying governments to hold their money for them, despite So we've got very, very little room for any more monetary policy because interest rates are at zero, and still we've got very, very weak growth. And the thesis of secular stagnation, which has been developed by Larry Summers and others, we can take issue with many parts of it, suggests that we simply now don't have economies which can generate the kind of demand that you need to get growth at positive interest rates, which is a unique situation. We haven't been in that situation before at all, and this is deeply abnormal. And we've still got quantitative easing going on. So as well as these negative interest rates, we've got money being pumped into the economy, and still we've got unstable and very limited growth. So this is a very abnormal situation we're in today. What makes it even more extraordinary is that that growth is not benefiting the vast majority of people in developed economies. This is particularly true in the US, where in 2014, the median household income, so that's the central place in the income distribution, was barely higher than it had been in 1990. In 1990, 25 years before, even though the economy, in terms of gross GDP terms, had grown by 78% in that period. That is, there'd been 78% growth of the American economy, but the average household had seen barely any growth in incomes at all. Now, that is a dysfunctional economy on any kind of basis. An economy is there to improve the living standards of the population. It's less stark in the rest of Europe, in UK and others, but in all advanced economies, the shares of GDP, which are going to the lower half of the distribution, have declined, and the shares going to the very top 1% have hugely increased. The labour share of growth is on the decline, while the profit share has been rising. And this is now manifest, as Thomas Piketty and others have shown, in rising wealth inequality as well as income inequality. Just this statistic: in the US, between 1975 and 2012, the top 1% of the income distribution gained 47% of the total income growth in the economy. The top 1% getting 47% of it. And in the first 3 years after the crash between 2008 and 2012, 91% of the gains in growth went to the top 1% in the US. This is an income distribution which is deeply skewed. The third problem we point to is the problem of environmental stress and climate change. Again, for a very long period, 200 years, we've been running an economy on fossil fuels, which we now know are generating completely unsustainable rates of greenhouse gas emissions and causing tremendous risk to future prosperity through climate change. But not only climate change. We are now, as many scientists have pointed out, at or close to the planetary boundaries of the capacity that the biosphere has to absorb pollution absorb environmental degradation. So we are suffering a series of environmental stresses symptoms, of which climate change is only the most severe. These problems, weak and unstable growth, stagnant living standards and rising inequality, environmental stress and climate change, are not temporary problems. They are not the problems of this immediate business cycle. They are deep and they are structural. And our argument is that to understand them, we need a much richer understanding of economics and of the way in which our capitalist systems work. We use the phrase in the book, the orthodox model of economics, and we are very conscious that there are many economists, there are lots of shades of economics, there are people working in all kinds of different traditions. But what we understand to be the orthodox model, which dominates certainly in economics teaching and in economics commentary and discourse, in public discourse, is a very simple one, based on the idea of profit-motivated firms operating in competitive markets, markets which tend towards equilibrium, and that's how we understand them, whose market competition generates efficiency and therefore maximises welfare, in which firms are kind of idealised actors which operate in similar ways or the same ways because of the pressures they face in the markets that they work in, and in which that competition and profit motivation generates innovation, which then generates growth. That view of the economy tends to lead, because it is a view which says that markets essentially work well, tends to lead to a policy framework of a relative lack of government intervention. There is, of course, a very strong part of this thesis which says that markets fail. Markets fail when there are externalities, when there are information asymmetries, and so on. But governments fail too. This is a crucial part of the theory. We can always point out the market failures, but if you want to intervene, you need to be aware of the government failures as well. And so you have a drift towards policy recommendation, which is to minimise government policies, that you should have balanced budgets, by and large, that government should not seek to influence the direction of the investment for fear of crowding out private investment, that you should privatise utilities and public services, that inequality is the price of entrepreneurship and growth. It's a beguilingly simple framework, but it does not describe the real world of actually existing capitalist economies. And it's inadequate as a way of trying to understand them. Markets do not behave as suggested in textbooks. Market framework is an inadequate framework to understand the pervasive and systematic problems that markets can generate. These idealized theories assume away many of capitalism's most important structures and features. And if you're trying to address these three huge sets of problems with which we are now beset, they don't get you very far. And in our book, we have a series of chapters written by different authors which try and go through these. So we have a couple of authors, Stephanie Kelton, Randall Ray, looking at fiscal and monetary policy and the ways in which fiscal and monetary policy can be rethought in order to generate better policy. Several chapters, including by Mariana, by Stephanie, by Bill Lozonik, and Andrew Haldane, chief economist of the Bank of England, look at investment and innovation. Why have we got such a low rate of investment? Andrew Haldane points to short-termism in the financial markets. Mariana points to the process of innovation. Bill Lozonik looks at the way in which we theorise firms. He points out that firms in perfectly competitive markets would only behave exactly as one another, in which case, how would you ever get innovation? It is because firms are not like one another, they don't behave in the same ways as markets, that you get innovation and growth. We have two chapters by Joseph Stiglitz and by Colin Crouch, which look at some of the key theories within economics about inequality. Joseph Stiglitz looks at inequality and says, firstly, you cannot justify the kinds of rewards that the economy now generates by the reference to marginal utility and marginal rewards. What you've got in an economy now is rent-seeking, people taking much more value out of the economy at the top of the income distribution than they deserve to through productivity, and also this doesn't support growth. Colin Crouch makes a powerful case that privatisation, far from generating greater market competition in utilities or public services, has merely created new oligopolies, which are increasingly not under public control at all. And he points to the creation of a small number of firms in the UK, G4S, Serco, Capita, and so on, who've hoovered up almost all public outsourcing contracts and who are now influencing the way in which policy is being made. Dimitri Zengeles and Carlota Perez look at the environmental problem and look at the way we need to understand the structural features of carbon within the economy and the ways in which the waves of innovation and technological change, which is Carlota's long-standing field, have generated structural change in economies before and transformation, and the way in which we can see the climate crisis, environmental crisis, as a potential for a new wave of technological change which could help solve some of those problems and generate a more balanced growth. So the appeal made in this book, the argument made in this book, is for a richer understanding of the actually existing capitalism that we face today. Not the theorised abstract concepts of a theoretical form of economics, but an institutional evolutionary model which looks at the way in which capitalist economies behave in the actual world we live in. And it's only through the development of such an economics, which I hope we'll hear a little bit more about today, that we can address these deep problems we now face.
Okay. So I'm Mariana, so I'm going to go back here because I can't stand there between these two guys. We'll feel claustrophobic. By the way, I saw a lacrosse player. You are the first lacrosse player I see in this country. I used to play lacrosse in high school. It's very good. Anyway, so for me, the big moment, as well as obviously the moment that Michael mentioned with the Queen, but the big moment that made me think we have to write this book was in May 2015, when the Labour Party lost, and many of us, I don't know if I can say all of us, many of us were quite upset. And day two of the loss, the newspaper articles that came out by some leaders of the Labour Party, saying things like, we lost because we didn't embrace the wealth creators. The question is, you know, who are the wealth creators? Who creates wealth in the economy? And if you read on in this article, these were the entrepreneurs, these were the businesses, and somehow Labour hadn't been business-friendly enough. And this, to be honest, that day two depressed me even more than day one when the election was lost, because it really made me realize that, you know, the reason that Labour lost, but in general, so much of the, let's just call it progressive parties, but people and also civil society organizations are in some ways losing, is we haven't really debunked actively the theory of where the hell wealth comes from in the first place. And so having actually a progressive agenda that's not just about redistribution, as important as redistribution is, and we should all be fighting, I think, especially economists for rethinking ways to redistribute in creative ways, we actually need to first talk about where the wealth comes from that is being redistributed. So rethink value. Where does value come from? And this isn't helped by words like we need to be business friendly. Why is that? Because actually wealth is collectively produced. There's lots of different actors, but even the word market, which is often used, right? The state is here, the market is there, and, you know, some people are for or against intervention, that word intervention in this thing called the market, that's very misplaced. What are markets? Markets themselves are outcomes, right? They're outcomes of this collective interaction between heterogeneous actors, different types of companies, small, medium, and large, and different sectors and different types of corporate governance, different types of public actors, whether we're talking about the BBC or the Department of Education or the DARPA kind of R&D agency, which was very important for the advent of the internet, right? So different types of public actors, very important. Third sector actors, if anyone studies health, you'll know how important the third sector is, as well as civil society types of pressures, also, for example, from the labor movement. We all have weekends simply because some people organize themselves to fight for weekends. We work 8 hours a day and not 24 hours a day because of that as well. And those pressures and those battles also were part of that market formation process. So the very vocabulary we use should be careful to not, if you want, reproduce the problem. So if we say, no, the state, of course it should intervene in the market because of X, Y, and Z, that's already starting off on the wrong foot, right? Again, the market is an outcome, so we can talk about different types of public and private actors and whether, you know, how we want them to actually interact, but using that word market as though it's the boogeyman has also then justified certain problematic behaviors. So the word market pressure. Yeah, sorry, we're doing all these share buybacks, but there's the market pressure. Well, no. There's different choices that can be made, precisely because there's different types of public and private actors and choices to be made there, which I'll talk about again in a minute. But then this also means, if you think of markets as outcomes, that policymaking itself should be pretty explicit in terms of its role in shaping, actively shaping, and sometimes actively creating the market itself. And yet so much of the framework that we use in economics, but not only economics, I'm often also critical of my community, the innovation studies community, that we're simply, if you want, through policy, fixing a problem. So whether this is some sort of market failure, which might come about because of positive or negative externalities, positive externalities when you have a public good, like basic research, the state has to come in there because the private sector is not investing in it enough, or a negative externality like pollution, you need the state to come in and fix that problem through something like a carbon tax. This notion that you just come in and fix things when they go wrong is quite problematic if we actually, again, step back and remember, that, wait, hold on, markets are outcomes, so this should really be about actively shaping and creating markets. So what is the market outcome we want, and how can we also change the types of interactions we have to get there, instead of fixing something that is seen as external. And also, from a policymaking point of view, there should be lots more attention to, in fact, the form of these different actors. So Michael mentioned this whole question of financialization of the real economy, right? So there's both financialization in terms of the size of the financial sector relative to the rest of the economy, which he mentioned has grown. But another even greater and related problem is this whole financialization of business itself. And we can measure that through things like share buybacks, which he mentioned, which are used to boost stock prices, stock options, and surprise, surprise, executive pay. But actually, when you look at different private organizations in different sectors, and SPRU, by the way, where I'm part of, and Johann Schott here is the director, SPRU has been very important in its looking at sectors, variety of different innovation dynamics in different sectors. So Keith Pavitt, one of the historic figures in SPRU, looked at the taxonomy of innovation in different types of sectors, depending how innovation occurred there. I won't go into that, but the point is there's huge heterogeneity between sectors, but also between firms within sectors. And in fact, on this metric of financialization, if we just take this problem of share buybacks that Lozonik writes about in his chapter, not all firms do that, right? So in telecoms, for example, the number one telecoms company in the world, let's see if anyone knows what it is, just shout it out. Okay, you guys aren't very participative. Huawei, number one company, right? Chinese company. No share buybacks. It's a cooperative. I always tell them that they should make more of the fact that they're a cooperative because no one knows that. One of the second companies, Ericsson, Swedish company, hardly any share buybacks. Cisco, if we take the telecoms area widely speaking, massive share buybacks. It's one of the companies alongside Exxon that has the highest level, so more than 100% of its net income used in either share buybacks or dividends. So there's choices to be made. There's a heterogeneity, which evolutionary economics, which I sort of see myself as part of that big body of thinkers, evolutionary economics is always talking about this role of variety, but that also should be translated into policy, not just in terms of what the state does and looking at, you know, variety of different types of policy instruments, but recognizing that business itself is very heterogeneous, and sometimes perhaps before creating a subsidy or an investment that is actually benefiting particular types of businesses, one should ask, well, what should the exchange then be for that sort of, you know, public subsidy or public investment in terms of the kind of behavior we might want from that private firm or private firms in that sector? So reinvestment of profits back into the real economy, whether that be in, you know, human capital formation, training, or research and development, should perhaps be something that policymakers think more about when they then recognize, again, these differences that exist out there. And, of course, those differences are due also to something very important, which people have written about, of varieties of capitalism. Capitalism itself is not this one big blob, hence the need also to rethink different forms of capitalism, but there's a variety, and these varieties of capitalism do affect corporate governance. Two, there's also different types of public organizations, of course. And I've actually personally been doing quite a bit of research on this, very interested in how some organizations in the public sector are quite explicit in terms of seeing their role as actively shaping and creating markets because they have missions. They have mission statements. This is more normal for private companies to admit they have mission statements, but, you know, a strategic, mission-oriented, problem-based public organization seeing their role explicitly as doing more than just fixing a particular type of market failure. Just think of the BBC in this country, how it's transformed broadcasting, how it's invested over time in its own capabilities and capacities. It actually came out with one of the first PCs, the BBC Micra. It's also invested in things like the iPlayer, so it hasn't outsourced all the knowledge, which is an increasing trend, which one of our chapters looks at through Colin Crouch's work. It's his chapter, sorry. So instead of outsourcing, it's been investing in-house, but also having big missions like the learning program in the 1980s. And the success of Arm, a company which, by the way, very sadly was just sold off to the Japanese SoftBank, Arm, which was one of the UK's most successful high-tech companies, came about through the BBC's learning program and its procurement policy. And so many companies around the world, definitely in the US, have in fact been crowded in, or I would say dynamized in, because crowding in still seems negative to me, right? You're still crowding someone. So crowding in is the opposite of crowding out. Crowded in through these kind of more bold, strategic, both supply side and demand side of, if you want, public investments. But not all public organizations are like that. I'm from Italy, even though I sound very American. We went to America when I was 5 years old. I'm from Italy, where the public sector, for example, doesn't see its role currently today. And I was just talking with two new PhD students who joined us, Tommaso and Simone, about this. Many public agencies in Italy just see the role as subsidizing or facilitating private institutions. So even the Italian public bank, called Cassa Depositi e Prestiti, is much less mission-oriented and strategic than, say, Germany's public bank. And these things matter. These different organizational forms in both public and private matter. And so, again, by looking at markets as outcomes of public and private interactions, we should be paying quite a bit of attention to this variety. Lastly, in terms of that point, we should also be focusing on the interactions between public and private, not just, you know, the organizational forms. So the interactions might also occur through tax, right? People don't realize that when NASA was founded under a president who was a general, so military, Republican, right, Trump today, the top marginal rate in the U.S. under Eisenhower was 91%. Okay, that's the top marginal rate with the richest people were paying. Capital gains was also much higher. Taxes themselves could be seen as a sort of interaction between public and private in terms of, you know, you're getting X, you're getting the infrastructure from the government, you're getting the educational system, you're getting all sorts of public investments and subsidies, and in exchange you pay tax. And what the tax rates are, and there's many different types of tax rates, often would come down to your understanding of what that public sector is for in the first place. And I've been very interested in how the narrative and the discourse, the vocabulary that's used around innovation and the innovation economy, the new economy, has actually been used quite regressively often to reduce taxes in a pretty dysfunctional way. So capital gains tax in the U.S. fell by 50%, 5-0, in just 5 years, through lobbying by the National Venture Capital Association, which was saying, you know, we're the risk takers, we're the great financiers, reduce our tax, when actually if you look at where venture capital has had its biggest effect, it's always been after the public sector laid down the groundwork in very highly capital-intensive, highly uncertain areas, crowding in, again, the business sector, and then, of course, VC comes in and does its thing, and venture capital is important, but this notion that they're the lone entrepreneurs and risk takers and hence reduce their tax to such an extent that then the public purse also suffers, which can no longer create that wave that they surf, is also putting, if you want, the innovation system at risk. Lastly, what is the implications of all this also for the austerity debate, which we sort of start off with also in the book, saying, you know, we need to rethink how we're even thinking about the causes of the crisis, what to do during it, and what will get us, if you want, out of it, is this kind of misplaced notion that the problem is either austerity, which Stephanie Kelton's chapter very clearly, if you want, debunks, or infrastructure, right? As if that's like the big panacea. Just go, you know, invest in bridges and roads and somehow everything's going to be fine. When actually the chapters of both Carlotta and Dimitris and Gellis very clearly say, hold on, both innovation and growth don't just have a rate, they also have a direction. And they talk about green as a new direction for the entire economy. And when we even talk about skills, everyone talks about skills and education and infrastructure as being sort of basic things we need. When we think about this, you know, the opposite of austerity being investment, the question of what kind of investment, what kind of directionality might we think about on both supply and demand, which can get us the kinds of transformational changes that we want. But also, just looking across Europe, something that I always say, just look at the numbers and actually ask yourself, why is it that we're doing what we're doing? Italy, again, where I'm from, for 20 years has had a low deficit, lower than Germany's. And I just gave a talk. I was invited by the Vice Chancellor of Germany, the Minister for the Economy, to go to the German Parliament about a week ago to give a talk. And I scolded them. I said, you know, you're going on and on about deficits, but Italy's deficit has been lower than yours for 20 years. The real problem in Italy and in Greece and in Spain and in Portugal, the famous pigs, I'm allowed to say that because I'm Italian. If you have a German calling the Italians and the Portuguese a bunch of pigs, you know, it's not okay. But this was a terrible word that Goldman Sachs came up with, the pigs, right? Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain. The reason that they are periphery and not core is not because the public sector was spending too much, but because both public and private weren't investing, and also they weren't interacting in interesting, more symbiotic ways, if you want. But Italy, you know, we've had 20 years of zero growth in productivity, very little public investment across the whole innovation chain, the kind of areas that, again, Spruce studies. So even if your numerator is growing at a relatively modest rate, between 2 and 4, it's not a big deal. If you're not investing both public and private on this wide array of areas that we need to be investing in to increase productivity and GDP, then in theory, that ratio can go to infinity. Right? Slowly rising denominator, slowly rising numerator, zero rising denominator, then you get a very high debt to GDP ratio, which is what we have in these weak countries. Not because the public sector was too big, but because it wasn't actually thinking perhaps strategically enough and not making these more direct investments, focusing too much on these indirect investments, which are just facilitating. Anyway, I have so much more to say, but I've gone 30 seconds over. Okay. Thank you.
Well, my chapter is the last one in the book, and it's titled Capitalism, Technology, and the Green Global Golden Age. It's an optimistic chapter. It's about the role of history in helping to shape the future. What I'm trying to explain is how we have to understand the moment we're living now, because it's not by chance that we had this huge bubble and this huge collapse. It's not by chance that after that collapse we've had this long recession. We are in something like the 1930s. And we have ahead the possibility of bringing about a golden age, which would be equivalent to what happened after the war, which was, you know, those 20 years that the French call the French call them the 30 glorious years, because really there was this incredible welfare jump. So I begin by wondering what, you know, many economists hold, that whether environmental policies are an obstacle to growth. They actually hold very often that they are. But on the other end, the people who are for the environment, for sustainability, they think that growth is an obstacle, and they're talking about degrowth and stop growth. I mean, this is even from the old Club of Rome thing done at MIT, that growth is supposed to have to stop because we don't have enough resources or this or that. Well, my answer to both of those, with a historical understanding of innovation, the answer is no. It's not an obstacle to growth, nor do we need, in order to have sustainability, to stop growth or to go back on growth. If we base it on the history of technological revolutions, we can argue that the environmental problems can be turned into the solutions for growth and well-being. So we turn problems into solutions. And this is based on the historical record. We have had, for every technological revolution, bubble prosperities, recessions, and golden ages. If we put the 5 technological revolutions in order, we have 2 main periods. One, which I call the installation period, which is the first 2 or 3 decades of each revolution. And the other, which is the deployment period, which is actually the golden ages of each of the technological revolutions, of which we have had 5. The Industrial Revolution in Britain, the Age of Steam and Railways, also in Britain, or started in Britain from 1829, and then the Age of Steel and Heavy Engineering, which was the first globalization, and that's when the USA and Germany started vying for leadership, and actually the USA ended up at the front. And then the next 2 revolutions, the Age of Oil, Autos, and Mass Production, which was centered in the USA, and our current ICT revolution, also started in the USA, but moving. Maybe the next one will be somewhere else, and maybe it'll be about biotech, nanotech, who knows? It's very difficult to predict. But once you have them there, you can see the pattern because the pattern is regular. What we have is two prosperities, very different ones. A bubble prosperity, which is this horrendous, unequal, everything else. The turning point when you shift to the new prosperity, hopefully, and that depends on whether the state comes in and acts very directly with a clear vision. And that I call the turning point, and that can last anywhere from 2 to 13 years, like in the 30s. We already have more than 8 years going into this one. So we had Canal Mania, then the Great British Leap, which was the first sort of golden age in a way. Actually, it was the war. Then the Railway Mania was followed by the Victorian Boom. The infrastructure collapses were followed by the Belle Époque in Europe and the Progressive Era in the USA. And we had the post-war golden age after the Roaring Twenties and all the crash of 29 and the long, long recession, depression of the 30s plus the Second World War. And now we have had internet mania, telecoms, emerging markets, the global financial casino, the housing bubbles, all these things. And we have had two bubbles this time. One, which was the Nasdaq bubble collapse, and the second, which was the 2008. Actually, the difference between these two bubbles is enormous because the first one was really about technology, which is what they usually are, and the second one was just a huge financial bubble of globalization using technology rather than creating more and more. Anyway, we could have ahead a global sustainable knowledge society golden age. It's perfectly possible. The question if it's probable, and it's going to depend on whether politicians can understand and whether this whole Trump sort of problem makes people realize that there is something seriously wrong, which is what this book is all about. We are in real trouble, economically, socially, environmentally, and every other imaginable way. That's what rethinking capitalism is about. And my role is to look at this particular feature of technological revolutions and how they tell us what to do. So the first half is led by finance with unfettered markets, and the second led by production, guided by the state. And we are here in the dark, low growth, feeble growth, backward period when we see all the bad things of the bubble. The inequality, and the financialization and all the rest. So that means that the equivalent historical period for the diffusion of the ICT revolution now is the 1930s. This is where we are. We are in a similar period, so we have things like Hitler and, you know, happening because that's it. It's exactly the same thing. People follow messianic leaders when they feel desperate, when they feel that they're being left behind, when everything is going bad. So that's precisely what's the nature of the turning point. Well, once the bubble collapses, the underlying state of the economy is revealed. Finance has become a casino, decoupled from production. All investment looks uncertain, and finance will not invest in it. The only guys that are investing are Google and Microsoft and all these. They're the ones. And Tesla going to the moon and whatever. You know, they're not solving the real problems. They're just doing these. They think technology solves everything, but they don't go and look at what they have to solve. They just go and invent problems that they can solve. So all investment does look uncertain, except those other things. We have no clear market signals. We have deflation and unemployment. Income is polarized. Inequality is stubborn. We have social unrest. Xenophobia. This is not the first time. These guys, they're guilty. That's the problem. And, of course, the messianic leaders. Economic migrations. Talk of secular stagnation and structural unemployment. You know, the first time that secular stagnation was used, the term, was in the 1930s. We're just picking it up. And the same thing about structural unemployment. Recession, so feeble growth, even depression. Yet there is a huge technological potential installed by the bubbles. What it lacks is a stable, synergistic direction, as Mariana was saying before, a mission, a vision, a direction for investment. You know, in the 1930s, you know, there was all this little investment, all the, you know, all the recession and all that. And then came the war. And guess what happened? Everybody discovered that mass production was miraculous and they could produce tons of airplanes, guns, whatever, bullets, everything in huge quantities. Even the women were doing it. And, so they discovered this fantastic thing, two fantastic things. One, that there was a huge technological potential that wasn't being used and could be used. Two, that it was great to work with the state because the state could do procurement and things could happen. And that's why they were able to put the 94% tax, the top rate, right after the war. So this understanding of this huge technological potential, today we are not understanding it. We have a new technological potential. And yes, robots are a problem, AI are a problem for jobs, but not for productivity. We can have jobs all over the place doing other things, which is what I will not be able to explain fully, but you can read the book. So how did policy in the post-war boom overcome the 1930s? Because we have to understand the nature of the task that the state has to face now. It is a huge task, and it has to be really bold. What did they do? Apart from the Keynesian management of fiscal and monetary policy, which are no small thing, huge acceptance of state intervention to get things going. There was also massive shaping of dynamic demand for mass production. So there was a particular technology capable of producing great quantities of things at a very low cost. Of course, that meant low cost of raw materials and low cost of energy, which meant that the third world stayed behind. But this, in the advanced world, they were able to have. They needed infrastructure for low-cost suburban housing. The automobile created the possibility of doing cheap house on cheap land because urban land was very expensive, but suburban land cost nothing practically because it was, you know, it was really far from the train station, from the trams, from everything. So cheap houses on cheap land. Then government guarantees for mortgages. You know Fannie Mae? Fannie Mae was created in the 30s. You know what for? To let the banks lend to the middle-class people with government guarantees. That's how mortgages were possible for people who didn't have, you know, who just had a salary or something. Unemployment insurance and pensions. Why did you need unemployment insurance? Well, people bought cars, people bought houses, and they had to pay every month, and they had a job. What if they lost the job? Oh, God! All the cars and the refrigerators and everything would go back, and the houses, the keys to the bank? No. Unemployment insurance would guarantee that payments would continue. And pensions. What are pensions for? Looked at in this way. Pensions are so people can spend their full month. It doesn't matter because when I'm old, I'm going to have an income. So look at the huge demand that that means. At the same time, you had official labor unions so that they would fight for the salary increases, which would make them be able to be consumerists. Because if you don't earn enough money, you cannot consume. And if you increase productivity, and through increasing production, you need more demand. So that's what that did too. Free education for the majorities and sometimes also health, so business didn't have to pay for that. Your salary was all to go to the mall and buy everything, go to the supermarket. And so was the weekend. Farm subsidies, prices low for consumers, and profits high for equipment. So the farm subsidies also had a demand-shaping role. Military procurement, well, obviously. Massive government employment and high taxes to pay for it. Of course, all those people that are working in government also had to go to the mall, also had to go to the supermarket, also had to buy the cars, also had to buy the houses. So in fact, it's a positive sum game. The Bretton Woods institutions for international finance and trade, and all that provided demand with two clear directions for innovation: the new suburban lifestyle and the Cold War. with an adequate and effective role for the state. So this is what happened that time. So what is the best precondition for successful policy? It's understanding the context being faced. So we have to understand what's happening now. Why did Keynes work then? It worked because we had national economies with mass production and consumption of identical products made and used with cheap oil and materials, mainly for the domestic market, with stable incomes from lifetime jobs. So if you put the money out, people would use it for demand, for buying some more of these things. But now we are facing a very different world. We have globalized economies with the WTO watching, with flexible production geared to diversified global markets, with potentially expensive energy and materials in a context of rapid innovation and unstable changing jobs. So you know what? Imagine that we were just to keep this unemployment insurance thing. Have you people heard of 0 hours contracts? So what do? Every other week when your boss says you don't work this week, you go and ask for unemployment insurance? How about the people who are now entrepreneurs, self-employed? What are they going to do? Are they going to go and say, look, I haven't had a contract for 3 months, I'm unemployed, give me some welfare payments? We've got to start really thinking of what can be done in this new economy, because it's very, very different from the old one. So we can't just apply the same policies. We've got to think of new ones that are adequate. So we need to keep the aims of Keynes, but we need to add a Schumpeterian understanding, which means understanding the specific technologies that are there for the use and design a new policy framework for dynamic innovation and markets in the information age, which is different from the one we just lived. So what could the new directions be? I think they could be green growth and full global development. Green growth understood as a constant increase in the proportion of intangibles in GDP and in lifestyles. Intangibles, so we reduce the material content and the energy content, and we increase the other things while improving the life of the great majorities. That means a lot of things: favoring renewable energy against fossil fuel, favoring services rather than products, drastic reduction of waste, massive increase in reuse and recycling, making durable products truly durable, shifting to a rental model with a lot of maintenance, reintroducing it with 3D printing of parts, accent on preventive health, exercise, creativity, and experiences. And, you know, you can invent a lot going along that direction. And why would full global development be in the interest of the advanced world? Because the third world's falling behind, I believe, was in the interest of a mass production world that needed cheap energy and cheap materials, and lots of it. Now, the world needs a lot of demand. So we really need also demand for special products, and that means that full global development would provide demand for advanced country specialization in capital goods, engineering, creativity, luxury, this and that. It would multiply trade flows, less concentrated in China and Asia, of course. So that means, and it would reduce poverty, violence, and therefore migrations, because if we could have Africa developing and Middle East developing, I'm not talking about 2 years. You know, we're talking about in which direction. We need a Marshall Plan for getting this whole thing going. So we need two sets of policies. One, change the context. And the other, modernize government. So we need to stimulate dynamic demand for innovation and investment, and also enabling government to handle the new context creatively. We have still inherited very bureaucratic structures, even though Mariana has well shown that lots of state institutions have been extremely creative and have helped innovation go ahead. There are many state institutions that remain bureaucratic and stiff, whereas businesses have become agile and, you know, very using the new technologies and the new way of organizing. So I don't think I have enough time to give you the ideas to consider for changing the context. That's the list. You can read the book. The changes, but one thing I will say is that the changes need to be as bold and imaginative as Bretton Woods and the welfare state. They've got to be bold and imaginative, and they have to be based on the nature of these technologies, on the consequences of using these technologies to increase productivity and to increase jobs and to increase wealth creation in general. So, but in order to do that, you can't just, you know, just wish and just redistribute income. You've got to find the way of creating the conditions for demand and for work, for jobs, for employment. So, and the aspects of the modernization of government, again, you can read the book. But the thing is that the longer we delay abandoning austerity and bringing the state back proactively, the longer the stagnation or the feeble jobless growth are likely to last. We are at the moment when either we do it, either we change the direction seriously. I mean, taxes have to be transformed completely. We cannot continue with the tax system now. We've got to be able, I mean, just, we should be taxing energy, materials, and transport, and not taxing people. VAT is a tax on jobs and profits, employment, incomes, and profits. Shift it. We've got to make sure that innovation goes in the direction of reducing energy, materials, and the rest, and that to use people for services. Use people. Don't tax it. Use people. You know, we have payroll taxes. That's mad. Anyway, stagnation is the problem we have, and changing the whole policy context is the solution. Thank you.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. It's a hard act to follow the amazing presentations we've heard. I wanted just to compliment what Stephen said, that I am attached to Columbia University, which I'm very proud of, but I have also worked at IDS for over 30 years, and I'm now an emeritus there, even though I'm still very young. I also want to say that I think this is a really good book, and because I think it's beginning to construct not just a thorough critique of economic theory, but also an alternative. An alternative is possible. And I think this is a very valuable element, and I'm really proud to be part of that book. And I'm also now involved in an exercise with Joe Stiglitz in trying to think through how to change the rules of the game in Europe as a follow-up to a book on changing the rules in the U.S., to redistribute income, but also to generate a new model of growth. So I want to start, and I will talk mainly about Europe, because I'm a crisologist, and that's where the best crisis at the moment is. So I just very briefly and slightly superficially want to refer to the causes of the crisis, which has already been referred to. I think it's very important to emphasize, because a lot of the comment on the crisis focuses on the mistakes that governments have made, particularly in Europe. And I think it's important to clarify that the main cause of this financial crisis, which started in the United States and then spread to Europe, started in the United States, it was the unfettered liberalization of financial markets with very weak and very insufficient regulation. And this is the main cause of the financial crisis. And I think it fits very nicely with kind of Mariana's framework that we create markets. People talk about the financial markets as if they are an entity, as if they are a hurricane. you know, we had a crisis because the markets collapsed. Well, we created these markets, exactly as you say, and we didn't regulate them. And it was this massive financial liberalization combined with the forces of globalization that caused this crisis, and which then allowed that spread to Europe and in particular to the Eurozone. There were, of course, other reasons why the crisis has been so bad in Europe. There were mistakes in the construction of the euro. There were structural reasons of poor development. But above all, I would argue, it was the appalling management of the Eurozone crisis which led to the major recession. And here, the policymakers and the politicians forgot all the lessons of history that you could have and all the lessons of economic theory. They forgot about the recession of the 1930s that Carlota was talking about and the solutions that Keynes as a theoretician and that Roosevelt as a politician came up with. They forgot about all the lessons from the very developmentally costly financial crises in Latin America, in Africa, in East Asia, and how badly it goes if you manage the crisis with a recessionary solution. And they particularly forgot that it would be especially bad in Europe because they imposed simultaneously austerity on countries that deeply trade with each other, that are closely interlinked with each other. And many people said this, that this wouldn't work. People like Krugman, like Stiglitz, Mariana, me, we were all saying it. But nobody was, the policymakers were repeating incredibly the same mistakes about that they could have avoided. They forgot about Keynes for a long time. And they imposed this austerity, not just on the deficit countries, but even Germany, who has a massive surplus. It has a current account surplus of over 8% of GDP, and Holland has a 10% surplus, they are also imposing austerity on themselves. So everybody is cutting wages. Everybody was cutting government spending. And because they all trade a lot with each other, they then impose collective austerity, sort of collective suicide pact. And, of course, the results were what could be expected. We have still today 21.5 million people unemployed in the European Union. We have countries where GDP has fallen over a quarter, over 25% is the fall of Greek GDP. But also larger countries like Italy, Spain, Portugal have seen GDP falls of over 5-6%. And we've seen massive rise of unemployment. As I said, over 21 million, almost 10% of unemployment in the European Union, but 25% in Greece, 22%, and over half of the young people, over half, one in two of the young people in Spain and in Greece are unemployed. What a failure. What a failure of economic policies. Really, really appalling. Declining share of industry, even in Germany, we have deindustrialization, and very sharp fall in investment. For example, the southern Eurozone, although much of the investment wasn't efficient, wasn't mission-oriented, it was quite high. It was 22%. That has been slashed since the crisis to 14%. It's fallen over a third. At a time when these countries need structural transformation, need aggregate demand, they're being slashed. And this fall in investment was both public and private. Fall in public investment because austerity was being imposed on this government, and fall in private investment because of, as Carlota explained, uncertainty, unwillingness of the financial sector to lend, and so on. And it is absolutely a disaster if in a moment when you need structural transformation to make Europe more competitive and, above all, to generate a new model of development, that we know what we want. We want it to be sustainable because the limits of the planet exist and we have to have our development compatible with that. It has to be inclusive so that it involves all citizens, and it has to be dynamic. For that, what do you need? You need mission-oriented investment. And if you're slashing and burning investment, both public and private, you're not achieving that aim. You're not able to incorporate innovation. You're not able to go into this new phase that Carlotta was talking about. And here it's very important, I think, from an analytical point of view, to stress that public investment crowds in private investment. Because the conventional, the orthodox theory says, we shouldn't increase public investment, A, because it will increase debt, but secondly, because it will take away valuable resources from the private sector. But we have unemployment. We have very cheap money because of QE. We have all the resources there, and so what increased public investment will do, as in the past, it will crowd in, not crowd out, private investment. And private investment will not grow on its own in this climate of uncertainty. And very mainstream people, it's not just us saying it, very mainstream people, like the International Monetary Fund, have been saying this with increased loudness. They've done empirical work which shows that public investment leads to growth, leads to more investment and more employment. Very rigorous econometric work. We've also, and in this paper with Giovanni Cosi that is in the book, shown that more growth, more investment, funded by more debt, if it's productively invested, will lead actually to lower debt to GDP. So it will diminish the burden of debt to GDP and the burden for future generations, not increase it. Recently, the IMF has also started saying, and it's very interesting, there's a number of recent papers, that it's good to have what is called an investment rule. So that if you take out key investments from, let's say, investment in innovation, in education, productive infrastructure, and you take that out of the deficit targets, and here I'm thinking of, for example, the Eurozone, countries are not allowed to have more than 3% deficit. But if you say, okay, you take out a part of this is called the golden rule, and you don't include that, this will lead to more growth. The very conservative, orthodox IMF, at least it's in its research papers, what it tells the Greek finance minister is something else. But at least they have provided evidence that this investment rule will make fiscal policy more countercyclical and will lead to more growth. And we have taken this, I'm working now with the only Keynesian economist in Germany, who's well known. He feels kind of lonely and he likes to come to our meetings because we really like him, he's very good. And the idea is precisely that maybe an idea that he's developing is that at least only 1% of the deficit of all European countries could be taken out, put what you call under the line, so it doesn't count. So that additional investment by the government, ideally, of course, in this kind of mission-oriented, focused way, not wasted, could lead to much more growth. And we calculated it would be about in the next 5 years, about 500 billion euros. Yeah? And if this was complemented by what already exists, although in rather weak form, measures that are being developed in the Eurozone, the so-called Juncker Plan, or the EFSI, to try and use public development banks, like the European Investment Bank, and like the highly successful KfW that Mariana and I have been studying, public development banks, to catalyze more funding to leverage the small increase in public investment channeled through these banks to finance additional private investment. Just to give you an example, in 2012, finally some good measure was taken by the EU governments, and they increased the capital of the European Investment Bank, the paid-in capital, by 10 billion euros, which is peanuts. You think about all the money they wasted on saving the private banks. And if you take those 10 billion euros, with that, the European Investment Bank can lend 80 billion. And because it co-finances with private banks and private investors, it can generate an investment additional of up to 160 billion. So you get this kind of leverage, which allows you to, with relatively scarce public resources, lead to a large increase in private investment. So this is a powerful tool, and which, of course, governments love because they feel fiscally constrained, because, as Mariana explained, people don't want to pay more tax, which would be the best solution. The rich people don't want to pay tax. So this is a sort of roundabout way of doing Keynesian policy without telling anybody. Very quiet. Don't tell anybody, but we're doing this in a quiet way. But the questions are, you know, is this plan going to work in the sense, will it, first of all, generate additional investment? Is the investment, because they're taking a bit, robbing from Peter to pay Paul, because they're taking actually resources that were already in the European Commission budget, and they're transferring to this, which is a good cause, but they're cutting other things. So will the investment be additional? Will it all happen? There's quite actually encouraging news, because in the first year they have actually performed about a third, or they say they have, of the investment. They say all the right things, that it's going to green infrastructure, to innovation, but I think we need to evaluate that carefully, whether that is happening. So is it enough? Is it additional? And is it mission-oriented enough? I mean, big question. We would argue that also it has to be accompanied by public investment. Because if not, you would be hobbling on one leg. You need to walk on two legs. And having this Juncker plan with continued austerity, so you're encouraging private investment on the one hand, but by cutting public investment, you're not giving it the support that you need. You're not giving it the direction that you need. But if you were to do both, you could have a plan that would be that could work to provide aggregate demand in the short term, which is important, because the growth is so anemic, including in Germany. Including in Germany, hasn't grown much more than 1% on average since the crisis. But above all, provide the funding for financing the structural transformation that we need in the European region and in the global economy. And there's one point I'd like to make, that in a way Europe has got a bit away with things, even though they're bad in Europe, because the rest of the world has been so dynamic. China has been very dynamic, the US has been fairly dynamic, and much of the emerging countries and low-income countries have been very dynamic. But this is changing. Particularly China is slowing down, it's becoming more inward-oriented, so less aggregate demand. The rest of the emerging markets are also slowing down, as unfortunately is Africa. And therefore, the Europeans can no longer rely on the stimulus that the rest of the world is providing. And they have to join also with having dynamism. Because if not, their very slow growth is damaging the rest of the world, particularly the poorest countries. Because if there's less demand coming from Europe, commodity prices are collapsing, foreign balance of payments are constrained. So there is damage, if we look at it from a development perspective, there's also damage for the rest of the world economy. So what are, and here I want to start finishing. So I've put a lot of emphasis, start finishing, 2 minutes. And so a lot of the emphasis in this paper is on investment, but I think it needs to be accompanied by increases in wages, increases in the share of labor in total income, because it has been decreasing so much. So redistribution is a complement to investment policies. Secondly, I want to emphasize that we've done simulations of this kind of exercise, and that you can see that you can accelerate growth up to double, and you can also lower the debt to GDP and decrease unemployment quite significantly. Not enough. You may need targeted policies, but you can decrease it by, say, over 5 million people, which is, of course, very important. And I just want to emphasize that there is a difference between the U.S. and Europe, because although the crisis started in the U.S., and although unemployment rates were on average about similar between the U.S. and Europe, they were about 10% after the crisis, unemployment has halved in the U.S. Unemployment is much lower in the U.S. today than in Europe. Growth has been higher and unemployment lower. So it's not a necessary consequence of the crisis. And one of the key reasons is because the U.S. has followed much more Keynesian policies. Especially when there was a fall in aggregate demand, the government stepped in and expanded aggregate demand. So there are solutions to this, especially if you put priority on, as was happened during this post-Bretton Woods period, in the 50s and 60s, if you have as one of your targets of economic policy by the European Central Bank, by the national governments, to have full employment, to have productive investment, as important or more as an inflation target or a fiscal deficit target. So this is an important... I'm just... One more point.
Okay.
Really one more point, I promise. So I think the key challenge is whether Europe will be able to do this. And I think the two elements. One is if there's a good economic analysis, and I think books like these really contribute to that. But the second is the political will to do something. And here, I will just finish with an anecdote. I was at a meeting with senior European policymakers, including the chair of the Eurogroup, the Dutch finance minister, Moscovici, the economic commissioner. And they were actually open to these ideas, much more open. I don't think it was because we were more eloquent than other times, but it was the week after Le Pen had done so well in the first round of the French elections. Luckily, she then didn't do so well in the second round. But at that moment, I really sensed that the politicians were looking for alternatives because they realized the risk of how close they were to the brink. And so, you know, of repeating the 30s, of these things that we academics keep saying and they don't listen. So I think there is the hope that here in the U.S. and in the developing world, people will respond to this populist xenophobic threat by positive alternatives, and that the positive alternatives, which are rational, based on good economic analysis, will be able to provide the growth, the employment, and the investment that average citizens in all over the world and in Europe need. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Shall I just go? Right. Well, I've got three really big disadvantages at this point. The first is that I'm coming last after some amazing speakers. The second is that I'm the only one of these speakers who doesn't have a chapter in the book. Big disadvantage. I'm really miffed about it. And the third is that I'm between you and discussion and then eventually drinks. So I'm going to be very rigid about my 10 minutes. But what I want to do is offer first a word of appreciation, then a suggestion about why a wider global lens is deeply relevant. Thirdly, about what that wider global lens might add and some questions it might ask that the book doesn't address. And finally, a question about widening discipline. So those are my four points. So the first, the appreciation. I think almost the greatest thing about this book is its double argument, the argument that capitalism has failed, but also the understandings of capitalism have failed, and that we need to address both of those. And this exploration of double failure is also, to me, a failure of practice and paradigm, of policy and the science informing it. It's a deeply Sprue kind of question, in a way. It's actually a book about the science-policy interface in economics and innovation and why it's failed. And I think that's really interesting and is actually an important conceptual take that actually has much wider implications. I also think that argument has much wider global relevance. So this is now the kind of beginning of a more global lens. We are in a highly global moment, and the challenges that the book talks about are highly relevant beyond the old industrialized countries of Europe and North America that are being talked about. So, reducing inequalities. As another book that was released last week, the World Social Science Report, on which IDS collaborated with the International Social Science Council, shows, this is absolutely not just Europe and the US. Economic inequalities over the last few decades have risen everywhere. They're intersecting with other forms of inequality in almost all countries, with those that are social, around gender, that are around cultural inequalities, fueling xenophobia. And they're compromising not just jobs and employment and the economy, but other kinds of societal goals around health, education, peace, access to justice, suppression of conflict. Inequalities really matter, and they really matter everywhere. The second is, of course, the challenge of accelerating sustainability, managing that green set of green transformations that we've been thinking about a lot in IDS, that are a recognition that the problems of climate change interlinked with land and biosphere degradation and pollution are affecting everyone everywhere across the world, and that unchecked, they will undo progress that has been made on reducing poverty and so on, as well as deeply compromising future economies. And connected with both of those, the inequality challenge, the environmental challenge, it's almost the most important of all, the challenge of building inclusive and secure societies in which people can feel safe and resilient from shocks, whether they're the shocks of climate change, the shocks of finance, the shocks of conflict. So all of those challenges are deeply relevant everywhere. Equally, development, and I was asked to provide a development lens, is now thoroughly global and universal. At IDS, we're now talking about kind of dismantling this divide between the third world and the rest, north and south, developing and developed countries. We're thinking about development as progressive change that addresses these interconnected challenges for everybody in Brighton as much as in Beijing or in Bamako. And indeed, that global interconnected compact, in a way, is now formally ratified by the Paris Agreement on climate change, or more importantly, by the global goals, the 17 Sustainable Development Goals, to which all countries and all governments committed last year. And I think a very interesting question, because the global goals do set out a transformative agenda for people and for planet, and they have reducing inequalities at their heart. Is this the kind of global Marshall Plan that Carlotta talked about? I think for a whole set of political and governance reasons, it's not at the moment. But at least in rhetoric, it kind of is. So that's the global interconnectedness and the deep relevance. But my third point is that I think if we take a wider global lens, we also begin to look at some experiences in other parts of the world that offer the potential both to add to and enrich and expand this brilliant book's arguments, but also to raise some issues and questions on which it's perhaps more silent than it might need to be. So just a couple of points here. Firstly, the book really richly documents the failures of Western capitalism in its own backyard. And we're hearing a lot about those failures. But a wider lens, historically and internationally, would also note how the export of that very model to countries in Africa and Asia from the 1980s through the so-called Washington Consensus, the series of neoliberal policy reforms that focused on rolling back the state, encouraging free markets, structural adjustment conditionalities, actually spread those failures and contributed to rising inequalities, insecurities, and unsustainability in countries of Africa and Asia. It would also note how elements of that neoliberal approach continue. In aid approaches focused on untrammeled private sector investment, and in turn how it's the failures of those failures that are now spilling back to affect the North in problems of migration and conflict. To a major extent, those are problems of our own making through the export of inappropriate economic policies that are failing also in our own backyard. But a little bit more positively, the book offers, I think, some really powerful rethinkings, and we've been hearing about some of them in people's talks. Markets are socially embedded, mission-oriented and patient finance, entrepreneurial, not just regulatory states, innovation for transformation, and new forms of contract between the public and the private. And I think the book really strongly recognises that these are actually more alive and well in real economies than economic orthodoxy would have us think. A wider global development lens, though, gives us many, many more examples. It shows, it multiplies the varieties of capitalism we might want to look at. And it gives us some really interesting exemplars of change in different contexts, historically and now. So we might think about some aspects of the East Asian miracle, so-called, of the 1980s, when so-called developmental states led some quite dramatic economic growth and rising living standards in places like Taiwan, South Korea, and to some extent Malaysia. We might look to Brazil's very sharp falls in inequality from 2006 under the policy regime of Evo Morales' government, and the progressive government-funded spending programs and the contributions there to environmental protection, though there's evidence that both of those have backtracked in recent years. Or we might look to China's experience with a very different variety of capitalism under a planned and socialized economy, low-income inequality until the 1980s, rapid economic growth with widening inequality and environmental degradation, and then evidence that since 2008, this very period when Europe and North America have been in turmoil, we're seeing actually the beginnings of reductions in economic inequality and the rise of social protection policies, and China starting to lead the world in green renewable energy, with some very interesting forms of public-private partnership leading the way. So I think we've got opportunities to kind of take this rethinking capitalism a bit further and to generate some more mutual learning across the rich varieties across the world. But to do that, and this is my final kind of little pair of points, would require, I think, two further expansions. One is to move beyond the state market dyad on which this book focuses so brilliantly and collapses that dyad in the ways that Mariana has shown us markets are socially shaped, to address actually the triad, the state, market, society, civil society triad. This is what we focused our IDS 50th anniversary conference on earlier this summer. And what that revealed was a rich diversity of forms of civil society action and innovation, some of it organized, some of it unruly and less organized, some of it quite hidden because not recognized in formal policy or orthodoxies. As the book we've produced last year, in fact, with a chapter from Mariana in it on the politics of green transformations, citizen innovation and the bottom-up transformation which can actually scale up and add up to the kind of big changes that Carlotta and others are talking about, really need to be taken notice of. But there's also a flip side to why we need to think harder, I think, about civil society. And that is that many of the examples of the so-called new developmental states, which would conform in rather neat ways to some of what we're being positive about this evening, mission-oriented, state-encouraged and led and shaped markets, are actually at the same time closing space for civil society. This is a salutary situation in Brazil where we're seeing actually the rolling back of some really innovative forms of public participation in policy setting right now. Or we can look to countries like Rwanda and Ethiopia, which have been lauded as new developmental states in Africa doing mission-oriented finance. At the same time, they're appearing to be highly repressive and authoritarian with respect to civil society. So I think we need to be aware of these downsides and bring an astute consideration of the civil into our lens. So finally, I think to do that, and this is my very last point, we need to expand our lens on rethinking capitalism beyond rethinking economics, which this book does so brilliantly. So what we have here in this book is the bringing in of some really important fields of economic thinking: institutional economics, evolutionary economics, Keynesian economics, and historical perspectives, and the economics of innovation. That's done beautifully. But I think economics in all its varieties also needs interdisciplinary engagement with the humanities, with anthropology, with sociology, with political science, and indeed with academic traditions that come from other parts of the world, from Latin America, from Africa, and elsewhere, if we're fully to understand both how capitalism is and isn't working now, how it could be understood better, and how alternatives might be imagined and start to spread. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Melissa. Right, so we have about 15 or so minutes for questions. Can I ask you, please, I think there are going to be one or two mics going around. Is that right? Okay, perfect. So, could I ask you, make it a question, make it snappy, and introduce yourself as we go, please. Nora.
Simon Maxwell. I work on climate in Europe, and I'm also an Emeritus Fellow of IDS. I have the book on my tablet and on my phone, and I can never find it because of all the other books I've downloaded about how the robots are going to take all our jobs. And those books often address the question, the IDS question, who gains, who loses. And I get really scared by the impact for, you know, Burundi, Bolivia, Burma, other places, poor countries, of a new technological revolution which starts in the north. And actually the technology takers not getting the innovators' rent will be in the south. What comfort can you give the poorest countries that the big shift in the global economy that you're recommending will not actually leave poor people in developing countries even further behind?
Is there another question? We'll gather three or four. Sir.
Hi there. My name's Robbie and I'm a student here. You mentioned a lot about sustainability and it's even on the front cover of your book. But if you look at World Bank statistics, as I was doing yesterday, you can see that the only time that CO2 emissions have fallen in the last 100 years have corresponded with a fall in GDP as well. I was wondering, you didn't seem to give any concrete suggestions of how you were going to change this relationship or concrete solutions of how you could decouple economic growth from CO2 emissions or environmental impact in more general terms.
Thank you. Is there one other question down? Peter, and then actually I'll take the in the green scarf. So Peter, and then here, please. Okay?
Thanks very much. Peter Holmes from the Economics Department. A comment leading to a question, if I may. It seems to me that actually, as an old-fashioned Keynesian economist, I would say that the Keynesian approach does come through quite satisfactorily from your model. The answer to the Queen's question is, well, in some sense, the stock market's a casino, and no one can ever predict who's going to win in the casino and when the bubble's going to burst. But thinking back historically to the crash of the 1930s, the debate between Keynes and Hayek was both saw capitalism collapsing because of sort of financial misinvestment, wrong investment signals given to the capitalists and doing the wrong thing. Hayek's view was that people had invested in the wrong things and just raising demand wouldn't get us out of the problem. Keynes thought generalized increased demand would do it. So that leads me to the sort of reading of what you're saying is we need to have Keynesian macroeconomic policy. We need to stimulate investment. But the twist in what you're saying is, in some sense, to go back to Hayek, it matters very much what you invest in. And then the question really is, how can we actually guarantee, for example, if we're going to invest in carbon capture and storage, it's going to be a lot of money. How can we be sure we get the technology right? Or does it matter? Can we just take a punt on this.
Great, thank you. Last question of this set here, please.
You talk about radical changes, including changes in taxation, but how do you see that happening within a context where tax havens keep popping up and multinationals have increased influence over national governments?
Great, thank you. Now, anyone?
Is that on? Yeah. Let me take the second question about GDP growth and greenhouse gas emissions. So globally, greenhouse gas emissions have been continuously rising, possibly until last year. So according to the early analysis of carbon dioxide emissions, not all greenhouse gas emissions, they were stable in 2014 and 2015 globally. And this does look like potentially a turning point. We don't know. A turning point you can't tell until you've gone several years past the initial. And that is because if you look at the trend of greenhouse gas emissions in the world, they are already on the decline in the developed world, and they have been now for 10 years. So the Europe first. So Europe has decoupled growth from GDP, from greenhouse gas emissions. So if you look at European growth, it's continued. It's a big fall and then rise again. Greenhouse gas emissions have been falling now for 15 years. In the US, starting a bit later, but are also now on a downward path, and that's true in the developed world. But of course, they've been rising very heavily in the developing world, particularly in China. And the reason that there may now be a leveling off is because China's emissions have begun to relatively decouple. So they're not yet out, but there is clearly now, they're not on a downward curve yet, but they are leveling off. And that's because China has taken very radical action to reduce particularly coal. So coal power stations are closing all over China, and they've taken, and that's largely an air pollution problem that they're addressing more than it is a climate one, but it has a great climate benefit. And so it is true that we have in the developed world partly reduced our emissions by exporting our emissions to developing countries. So a lot of the manufacturing that used to generate greenhouse gas emissions in developed countries has gone to the south. But even if you include that, our emissions are now on a downward path. And that is because, as Carlotta said, it is possible to generate growth, which is the value generated in GDP, in much less material intensive ways than it used to be. You can produce different things. If you look at the difference between records as they used to be made and downloads as they are now, there's a huge material and energy difference in the way in which we consume things. And because we are shifting gradually our energy systems away from fossil fuels towards renewable energies, and we've greatly increased the efficiency with which we use energy. So we're much, much more efficient in the way we use energy than we used before. So decoupling is possible of greenhouse gas emissions from GDP growth. We've shown how we can do it in developed countries. We have to do it, however, much more radically. And the problem we face, which is to make sure nobody is complacent about this, is the rate of buildup of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere means that we now have a very limited budget of remaining greenhouse gases that we can put into the atmosphere before we begin to overshoot the 2-degree rise in global average temperature, which the IPCC and the international community have argued should be regarded as some kind of tolerable target. That 2-degree rise is going to cause, and is already causing, immense suffering in developing countries. It's an average, it's in many places temperature rising more than that. Even at 2 degrees, you get tremendous changes in rainfall patterns, in storm surges, in droughts, and so on. So 2 degrees is not safe, it's not tolerable, but it may be all we are able to achieve. The Paris Agreement in December suggested we should even be trying to keep it to 1.5 degrees. We have a much faster rate of reduction to achieve now in order to get there. So this is not an argument for complacency, but it is an argument to say it can be done.
I'll take part of the first one, but maybe Melissa can follow on the development side. So I think your question, it was you, right? Yeah. Could also be applied to the so-called developed world. Like, how do we know that this, you know, great change, whether it's mission-oriented or not, is going to help, you know, is going to lead to inclusive growth? And I think there's two issues there, especially around mechanization and unemployment, which so many people are talking about. Are the robots going to take our jobs? Whose jobs? What's the effect going to be on profits and wages? The first is just to remember that David Ricardo
one of the first sort of proper economists in the sense that economics before his time, even in the time of Adam Smith, economics was somehow fused with philosophy, political science. It actually wasn't sort of a discipline in and of itself. So David Ricardo was one of the first sort of proper economists that wasn't also a philosopher. He wrote a book called Principles of Political Economy, where chapter 31, called On Machinery, was basically asking that question in a narrow way. But the question was, oh my God, all this industrialization, all this mechanization, all these new machines that are coming about, look what's happening to labor. So this whole issue of, does mechanization, which is somehow central to capitalism, already Marx was talking about that, is it going to displace labor and what to do about it? Now, what then happened for about 200 years was that as long as profits from the returns, let's just say, of innovation were then being reinvested back into the real economy, many jobs were lost from mechanization, but new jobs were created. You could call this creative destruction or whatever. The big crisis that we talk about in the book today is actually an investment crisis on both the public and the private side, which has actually stopped that renewal process. Now, that doesn't tell you whether these are good jobs or bad jobs, or whether the change that we are, you know, that this innovation is coming about is sort of good for the people in terms of if it's, you know, causing more pollution or not. But just in terms of the jobs, what we talk about is that this financialization and austerity have actually put that reinvestment cycle, which for 200 years was guaranteeing that innovation might take away some jobs and produce others, has halted that. Second is that one of the whole points of saying that what governments do is not just fix markets but actually create them isn't a normative point. This isn't necessarily good. So shale gas and fracking was basically all funded by the US DOE, and later the private sector came in. It was crowded into that area as well. What this should actually, you know, imply is also to have greater, I don't know if I would call it civil society, especially after this referendum we've just had, I've become a bit worried about asking the people what they think. No, just kidding. But, you know, we should definitely have democratic processes in place, and we can decide how to go about that to also control or to, you know, put checks and balances in place so we admit this directionality. Precisely because innovation doesn't just have a rate but a direction. What do we know about the direction? And the work of Andy Sterling, who's in both Steps and in Sprue, has been fundamental for that. Lastly, this whole question of the deal. You know, we don't just need a new deal, we need a deal. And so, for example, one of the things that's really hurt developing countries is the lack of negotiation on the deals, for example, around international property rights, around innovation. And I don't know who the hell thought of the word rights. These aren't rights, they're contracts that need to be negotiated. But what we've seen in the last 30 years is that patenting is increasingly going upstream. So the tools for research are being patented. They're increasingly wide, so they're blocking innovation instead of spurring it. And they're very, very strong, so they're not licensing enough. And this has especially hurt developing countries. And that's just one example. There's all sorts of other deals that would have to be in place to make sure that, you know, we get productive and not unproductive entrepreneurship. And anyway, this isn't a complete answer to your question, but again, all these things are about admitting that they need to be negotiated and that the direction needs to be explicitly checked by different types of forces, whether they're civil society or not.
I'm not going to be able to, well, just to complement what Marianne has said and there's some response to Simon's question, I wonder if we also need to rethink a bit how we imagine and categorise jobs and employment. Maybe part of this transformation is to move beyond those classic distinctions between productive and reproductive and care work, to recognise that there are jobs that are about distribution. They're a part of what James Ferguson earlier in the summer called the distributive economy. They are in services. We're also seeing all sorts of new economic forms springing up, often in quite marginal places across the world. Alternative economies, solidarity economies, based on much more collective forms, often quite localised, but offering the seeds of alternatives, which you could imagine spreading further, which then might require rather different types of state support. I mean, the combination of a kind of universal basic income model, plus then the ability to foster forms of innovation and services which aren't classically productive in the income-earning sense, I think offer ways forward. So we need, I think, some more imagination. And then possibly there are some of the I mean, outside the heartland of Western Europe and North America, I think there are opportunities for leapfrogging that we're already seeing happen in the innovation sector, in the economy, in green economies, that are there precisely because the lock-in to established paths is not as strong as it is in Europe and North America. And I think that is also a source of hope when I've got my more optimistic hat on.
Yeah, I want to, if I may just add also, it's not just the technological path that is fixed, as you rightly said, Melissa, but it's also vested interests in favor of fossil fuel, in favor of big finance, which are not so deeply embedded. So if you're thinking of how to develop the financial sector in poor countries, they don't have a big one, so they might be able to do it better. And they don't. If you're in Chile, they don't have a big fossil fuel industry, so they may jump quicker into green energy. So I think that's very important. But I just wanted to try and answer Peter Holmes' very nice question about not just generate enough investment, but the right kind of investment. Although I don't like Hayek, but let's say that there are other people who also said that. But I think part of the well, we share the love of Keynes, of course, Peter. I think part of the answer is having the right institutions, the right mechanisms, and the right incentives that will help deliver this kind of more focused, mission-oriented finance in the right sectors, trying to be in the right sectors. I don't think there's a certain answer. But, for example, Mariana and I share a love of good public development banks, which are institutions which are funded by governments, which can channel long-term patient capital to strategic sectors. And we have examples where it works. For example, in China. China has the largest, by far, public development bank. And when they decide to do solar, they do solar. And they do it at an amazing pace and at an amazing speed. When the Germans decide they want to have what they call the Energiewende, energy efficiency and renewable energy, they put in a policy framework through the government, they put in a financial institution like KfW, they just call them up and say, you just do it. And they work closely with the private sector. And they just do this in a very speedy way, not in a perfect way. But you need, therefore, good institutions, which I think need to in part be public, but working closely with the private sector. They need to have good governance. But you also need the right incentives in these institutions. For example, we've also discussed this whole issue of how you capture the upside. So you don't have that the government takes all the risks and the private sector makes all the profits, which is, of course, what the private sector always wants. They want all the guarantees, but they don't want the profits touched. So how you can create mechanisms so the profits can be shared and the risk can be shared, you have to give some concessions to the private sector, but you also have to protect the public resources so that you can rechannel them. So these are complicated, difficult issues, but there are solutions. We have examples of this, and I think this can be done.
Well, a little bit to each. Yes, what you invest in matters a lot. And one of the ways, not only what the state invests in, but also what is made profitable for the private sector. So this whole idea of having green growth as a central way of defining policy and being systemic about it would mean that if people reduce their energy or reduce their materials, then they pay less taxes on it. If they make it nearer, if you have agriculture right near the city, then you pay less taxes than you would the other way, so it becomes more profitable, it becomes more, and all the regulation in favor and etc. That would make a huge difference in terms of how investment is made. And the whole thing is that because historically each time there is one of these sort of golden age periods, there has been a huge change both in lifestyles and in production methods and in what is produced, then the whole problem is to unleash this change. And that's where, you know, if you look back, I mean, we didn't have plastics in the third revolution,
The fourth revolution was all about this enormous amount of innovation in plastics for clothing, for packaging, for the, and waste and all these things. And now we're trying to take that back. So somehow the whole problem of where you invest has to do with both the technological revolution and the policies that push you in one direction or in another. And there I come to the increase in CO2. This is the first revolution that is not about increasing materials, but about increasing information processing and information services and information whatever. So there is, in the nature of this revolution, a potential for being guided towards less materials, less energy, less... So it isn't just because there is the green policy. It's also because this is a set of technologies that would allow lifestyles that are greener, that include less materials and less whatever. And finally, hope for the poorest. I don't think capitalism ever gives help to the poorest. So, you know, I think we're in trouble. So we've got to try to somehow solve it. But there are things in this technology that do give some hope, as Melissa was mentioning, the leapfrogging method. I mean, Kenya didn't put in the big telecoms things with all the cables and all that. Of course, it's not fantastic internet, but it's internet for everybody by using just the mobile part. The banking, people in villages now can have banks through the mobile phone. And that's not an invention in the advanced world. What's an invention in the advanced world was the mobile phone and the internet. But the use and the fact they even have a system for delivering things with motorcycles and bicycles, which is like a sort of, you know, like an Uber or whatever, one of these internet-based things, which is with a mobile phone, and then they have a whole thing for delivering, which creates a lot of employment. So there are many things that can happen, and there is also another very important thing, which is that the world markets are hyper-segmented, so there are little niche markets that people can approach, and therefore the possibility of having wealth-creating activities across the territory in whichever country, I don't know, you know, the poorest of the poor, perhaps not, but certainly in Latin America, for instance, one could think of a lot of production of things that are related to agriculture or whatever, and they have, there are niche markets that you can approach. And finally, a very important aspect of this paradigm, of this whole technological revolution. Mass production was the equalizer. It meant that everybody had to copy the American way of life. So it destroyed all the artisan things, it destroyed identities, it destroyed anything that had to do with difference. You had to be the same in order to be able to produce a lot of cheap things. They had to be identical. That was the principle of mass production. Now we have the principle of flexibility, diversity, and differentiation. So that, in fact, we have an incredible opportunity of bringing back the identities, bringing back the cultural differences, religious differences, whatever, and to make a very diversified but equally satisfied world. We can have a very, very different world if and only if we understand it politically, because we need to understand the nature of the technology to be able to gear it in the right direction.
Thank you, Carlotta. That's brilliant. Last word on the questions to Michael, and we have two more things to do before we go.
The final question was about whether any of this can be done given the power of multinational corporations, given tax havens in which the world is... in which huge tax revenues are taken away from government. And there's a very short answer to this, which is that is a huge form of resistance to change, but it is only political action and political will which can make any of these things happen. What you've heard here is the extraordinary potential in new technologies, in the power of state institutions, public institutions, in civil society and so on, but there is huge resistance as well. One of the reasons that neoliberal economics has been so powerful in gripping public discourse and in gripping policy making is because it serves the interests of the powerful. And it is not a surprise that form of economics has become dominant. It's not a separate. It's not as if the academic world and public discourse exist separate from the powers in society and economy. So there are huge resistances, not just to the program of policy, but also to the ideas. But it is only through political will, on an international basis, because we now live in a globalized world, that these things are going to happen. And this becomes then part of a political project. And one of the things that we're doing out of the book is we're trying to develop a kind of network of people of interest, of economists, of policymakers who are interested in alternatives, in order that we can build, along with huge efforts in civil society, which are now occurring around the world, enough of a momentum and a critical mass behind change. But that change will have to occur through political action, and that has always been true and it remains true.
Thank you very much, Michael. Okay, so last two items to do. First, there was a competition, a student competition, where we asked the winners to ask how you would go about rethinking capitalism. And we have five prize winners, and I hope most all of them are still here. So they are the following students. Can I ask, and the prize is a book signed by both of the editors. So, and a kiss. There you are. So you get your choice on the editor on that. Jake Woodyer, Elodie Mouchembled, Louis Stecklmacher, Marco Carreras, and Simone Gasparin. If you could all come up, please. Congratulations. So yeah, this by the way, two of them are undergraduate students. Elodie and Louis are undergrads. Marco and Simone are PhD students in SPRU. Jake is doing a master's in environment development and policy. Congratulations, everyone. Great. And on that very happy note, it just leaves me to thank you all for coming tonight, and thank you for going through a very, very interesting discussion. Let me thank all the panelists. It's really very, very enjoyable. So a round of applause for everybody, I suppose, really. And so we have a number of treats up there. We have, I think, some wine, canapes, and crucially, copies of the book. And as you know, Carlotta is expecting all of you to read the book very closely. Thank you very much, and have a good evening.